That's Fred Reiter wailing away on the New York Ska Jazz Ensemble's rendition of the jazz standard Harlem Nocturne, recorded live in 1995. That's from the ensemble's 1995 to 2004 collection album. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. It is Thursday, November the 13th. And having struck an agreement in principle with China to jointly lead global initiatives to combat climate change, President Barack Obama is in Myanmar today for the 25th annual summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, comprising the sixth largest economy in the world. Tomorrow he arrives in Brisbane, Australia, for the ninth summit meeting of the G20 nations. Still reeling from a trouncing by Republicans, Obama is pushing hard to make the mileage he's putting in pay off. Voters did rebuke his domestic policies, and so the pivot toward Asia is a centerpiece of his foreign policy, at hoping he will gain something by it, because the Democrats badly need some points. The problem is that the United States isn't exactly getting rave reviews in that part of the world. Besides, they have significantly changed the power equation between themselves as some of the largest economies in the world and the United States. Diplomatic scholar, historian, and prolific author Dr. Gerald Horn, the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, is our guest today, helping us, as usual, decipher whether the Asian climate change accord bodes well for Obama's pivot. Professor Horn has written more than 30 books and more than 100 scholarly papers and reviews on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. His latest books are Race to Revolution, The U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, and The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. Both of these books were topics of discussion right here at Lead Stories. And it's great to have you with us again, Gerald. Are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. I'm saying it's great to have you with us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for being with us. All right. So let's talk first about this much ballyhooed accord struck between China and the United States yesterday. I'm looking at the tone of the coverage, and some interesting characteristics jump out at me. One, the effort to make it look as if the United States compelled China somehow to come around to doing the right thing. And number two, that based on what was possible and what was possible in terms of a broader agenda, the accord on climate change, though significant, was nonetheless, it fell far short of what was possible in such a meeting. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, point number one is the response from incoming Senate Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who denounced this accord. And I think that denunciation needs to be placed in context, particularly in light of these elections that you mentioned a moment or two ago. That is to say, I think that many of our friends on the left don't seem to recognize that in the United States of America, you have a powerful right-wing populist movement within the Euro-American community that has sunk deep roots in the working class and the middle class. This is nothing new. This has been in place at least since the end of the 18th century. And yet, it seems our friends on the left seem to be preoccupied with what I consider to be a delusion. That is to say that the reason why these white workers and white middle class folk have been voting for the right is because the Democrats are not sufficiently to the left. If that were the case, it would seem to me that black voters would also be voting for the right. And when you pose that question to these fellow leftists, they really have no response, because if they responded, they'd have to concede the point that you have this powerful right-wing populist movement. And because of this misestimation, this leads to further delusions. It also leads to a political analysis that does not take into account forces on the ground, but focuses on the real and imagined weaknesses of individuals, such as Barack Obama in the White House. And so, therefore, it seems to me that with regard to this climate change accord, from China's point of view, I would say that their point of view is closer to mine. That is to say, they recognize that you have a surging right-wing populist movement in the United States of America, that this movement has tendencies towards neo-fascism, and that they, on the other hand, would like to help to prop up Barack Obama by giving him a so-called deliverable that he can then take back to the U.S. people and tout it as showing that his policies are gaining accord abroad. Of course, we also know, and this is something, too, that's ignored by many of our friends on the left, that a good deal of the Euro-American population does not even accept the science of climate change. The incoming head of the Public Works Committee of the U.S. Senate, which has jurisdiction over climate change, is amongst those. And so if you're not even accepting the science of climate change, well, then obviously you're going to denounce this accord by President Obama brokered with China. And I think that because of this failure to come to grips with reality, this leads to fundamental misjudgments about the nature of this country. And if we're not careful, we're all going to end up in internment camps.
Well, it was very subtle and yet very powerful that this accord actually affirmed a dramatic shift in the power equation between China and the United States. Here, China was not, quote, compelled, unquote, but quite the other way around. It seemed as if, in a very interesting way, that it was the United States that was compelled to meet China and meet a new China, a more robust China, a more confident China, a more, a more evolved China.
Well, we're living through one of the most momentous developments ever to take place in human history. I'm not only referring to the fact that according to the Financial Times of April 30 of 2014, by some estimates, the Chinese economy is now larger than the U.S. economy. And it seems to me it's difficult to talk about white supremacy, which, by the way, many of our friends on the left seem to only talk about in an abstract manner. How can we talk about white supremacy in the old way when China now has the largest economy? How can we even talk about the Cold War and the successful conclusion of the Cold War, allegedly on U.S. terms, when a communist party of 87 million members headquartered in Beijing now administers the largest economy in the world, when the Cold War was all about bringing communism to its knees, so we were told? How can we talk about politics globally or even domestically in the old way when the late Nobel laureate Robert Fogel of U.S. University of Chicago estimated that within decades, the Chinese economy would be larger 10 times larger than the U.S. economy. Yes, I said 10 times larger. It's not only that, but when Mr. Obama came into office, he had a policy in mind to try to deal with the situation. The policy involved a reset with Russia and a pivot towards Asia, meaning a pivot towards China. And to that end, he traveled to Australia a couple years ago to establish a U.S. military base in Darwin. And, of course, he tried to improve relations with the Moscow. But relations with Moscow are now, as you know, worse than relations with China, creating a formidable bloc that the United States is going to have difficulty dealing with for some years to come. In fact, since 2013, Vladimir Putin and President Xi Jinping of China have met 13 times. And I know people who date who haven't met 13 times since 2013. So this is a formidable national security challenge. It's a challenge so awesome that I seriously doubt that if a President Rand Paul or President Marco Rubio or President Jeb Bush or alternatively a President Bernie Sanders or President Elizabeth Warren could really deal with this challenge. But instead of having an analysis of forces, not least historical forces that have brought us to this moment, once again, we just get these rather insipid and weak personality dissections of Barack Obama, even though he'll be leaving in November 2016, which makes me wonder what people are going to talk about then.
Well, let's take a look at this pivot, which you've begun to describe, and the strategy that the United States has. There is still, I mean, even though it's clear that the United States has come to the conclusion that it cannot ignore China anymore. It cannot ignore the burgeoning economies such as the Association of Southeastern Nations, which just also had its summit meeting. It cannot ignore these economies. They are robust, and in many cases, they threaten to dwarf that of the United States if they keep growing at this rate. But at the same time, we have this unwillingness, or it's a psychological state of mind, I think, the idea that the United States just cannot let go of this idea that it is preordained to rule the world. So in this pivot to Asia, what do you see as the challenge that Barack Obama has had in terms of changing the mindset here in the United States? This is not to say that he doesn't himself believe some of this. He comes clearly from that perspective as well. If you listen to his speech yesterday, in which he still is talking, not even though China, I agree with you that China, in fact, gave him something to take back. It was like saying, here's a consolation prize. But at the same time, still cannot, even in his speech, let go of this idea that somehow he managed to compel this response from China.
Well, since you've lived in the United States for a while, I'm sure you recognize that it's part of U.S. national psychology to see itself as the leading power. With defeats in Afghanistan and Iraq and other sites too numerous to mention, suitable for ignoring. The problem is that it's not only that the center and right continue to be preoccupied with this delusion. A lot of our friends on the left are preoccupied with this delusion either. I mean, it's difficult to think of one black leader, one left-wing leader, indeed, who can give you a credible analysis not only of what we were just making reference to, that is to say the rise of China, but also how it happened and how it was facilitated by U.S. policy. Because we know that approximately four decades ago, President Richard M. Nixon traveled to Beijing in order to effectuate an entente with China on an anti-Moscow basis. And part of the payoff to China was this inward foreign direct investment from China and from the United States to China. And as we know today, one of the many things that's hampering a united U.S. confrontation with China is that so many U.S. corporations are so heavily invested in China. I'm speaking of Apple, Microsoft, General Motors, Starbucks, McDonald's hamburgers, all of the rest. And we also know that part of the payoff from China's point of view back to the United States was China going along with U.S. foreign policy, not only with regard to Moscow, but, for example, attacking Vietnam, which it did in 1979, and other misdeeds and sins too numerous to mention. We also know that the part of this obsessive anti-Moscow attitude that drove U.S. foreign policy was the weaponizing of Islam in Afghanistan in the 1980s in order to destabilize a Moscow-based regime in Kabul, which, as you know, has spread like an oil splotch, and now, of course, has spread into the Syria-Iraqi border with the so-called ISIS crisis, into Libya, with that Obama misadventure destabilizing the Gaddafi regime in Tripoli. And so because there is no historical understanding of how China got to this point and correspondingly how the United States was weakened, it's almost as if the U.S. left, right, and center would like to party as if it were 1999, as if the world has not changed, as if the United States did not have these formidable challenges, and as if we could continue to play this parlor game of blaming everything that happens on Barack Obama. Now, what's interesting is that the Wall Street Journal said today that if President Obama goes through with his executive order concerning immigration, that the Republicans are going to shut down the government. At least a faction of the Republicans would seek to shut down the government. And we know what happened in 2013 when that happened. It was basically chaos in the United States. And so we're facing that prospect once again. And once again, it seems that some of our more noted leaders and intellectuals are sitting on the sidelines, thumb-sucking, with no explanation or no understanding of what's befalling all of us.
Well, you give a very good clue to my next question here, which is, the president is undertaking this pivot, this trip through Asia and the region, at a time when his currency couldn't be lower. I mean, everybody knows that he suffered. His party was trounced, which is to say he was trounced. What kind of credibility does the president bring to any initiative now being undertaken in this Asian pivot that he's making as a leader representing the United States, given the outcome of the elections?
Well, it depends on the initiative. As I said, I think Beijing wanted to prop up President Obama and give him a deliverable, which they did with this climate change accord, which will probably be attacked mercilessly by Republicans within days and weeks. It also depends on what he proposes. Apparently, there's going to be some sort of free trade accord between China and the United States, which is interesting because this will probably weaken the working class base of President Obama here in the United States, that is to say the so-called free trade accord. That's been the history of these free trade accords, which will be an ironic repayment to the base for supporting the Democratic Party. President Obama today is in Myanmar, Burma, and that's two part of this encirclement of China policy, but that's probably going to backfire because the authorities in Myanmar, as you know, are embarked on a violent anti-Muslim campaign threatening to expel many of the Muslim nationals of Myanmar, which is not going to increase U.S. popularity in the Muslim world generally at a time when that is precisely at issue. He will be going to Brisbane, Australia, for the G20 meeting. And as noted, Australia has opened the doors for a U.S. base in Darwin, Northern Australia, which is part and parcel of a longstanding security alliance between Canberra and Washington. But at the same time, Australia has as its major trading partner China, one of the reasons why the lucky country, which is how Australia describes itself, has been able to escape the ravages of recession that have bedeviled Western Europe in particular. It's because of this privileged relationship with China. And so it's difficult to see how Australia is going to be a frontline state in this encirclement of China policy, which is part of the pivot, when its economy is dependent upon China. Likewise, South Korea, which houses 37,000 U.S. troops and has been close to the United States for many years and decades, and, of course, has a close trade relationship with the United States, as evidenced by the fact that probably many of the people listening to me are carrying Samsung mobile phones and have other kinds of Samsung devices or driving Hyundai cars and all the rest. But the fact of the matter is that China is probably South Korea's largest trading partner. South Korean popular culture is wildly popular in China, not only K-pop, that is to say the music from Seoul, but also the telenovelas and the soap operas and the movies. We hear a lot of talk, including on this program, about China's alleged incursions into Africa. But it seems to me that's just a way to not deal with the fact that there's been amazing Chinese incursions in the United States. Waldorf Astoria Hotel, right there in New York City, just bought by Chinese interests. Chinese capital is flooding into Manhattan real estate, into Southern California real estate. And that's not even to talk about the Chinese capital flooding into the European periphery. I'm speaking of Greece, Portugal, Spain, and Italy. Not only Chinese capital, but Chinese nationals increasingly are moving to these places and playing a prominent role in the economy. All of what I'm saying to you is that it's going to be very difficult for this pivot towards Asia to confront China to gain altitude, not least because that train has left the station. That is to say, it's probably too late for the pivot to gain traction. And in any case, it was going to be difficult because of a lack of awareness of the basic facts of life and history that I've just recounted to you, and lack of awareness that's not only part and parcel of the U.S. center and right, but also the U.S. left, I'm afraid.
You've been referring to the U.S. left quite consistently so far in our discussion. What is it about the U.S. left that you see here as a as impediment to progress?
Well, part of it, to be fair, is not their fault. What I mean is, as you know, I wrote this book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, where in addition to telling a story about how this country came into being in the late 18th century, I was also trying to make a contemporary point, a political analysis, which is that the establishment of the United States of America was not a great leap forward for humanity. In many ways, it was the establishment of a Rhodesia, that is to say a white supremacist state in North America. And even though we Africans in particular have been going toe-to-toe with this Rhodesian in North America for decades, if not centuries, and have been able to push it back somewhat, as suggested in evidence by the continued popularity of right-wing populism in the Euro-American working class and middle class, it's very difficult for a left wing to gain traction and popularity in the United States of America. Now, on the one hand, that speaks to why the left wing historically has been so weak in the United States of America. Indeed, we have a control group, that is Canada, which was also a British colony, but did not rebel against British rule, and yet it stands to the left of the United States. You would think that the Revolutionary Republic, that is to say the so-called United States of America, would be in the vanguard of human progress, but it's Canada that has the single-payer healthcare system and other indicators of a civilized lifestyle, not the United States of America. And by the way, parenthesis, as you know, the U.S. Supreme Court is about to tackle Obamacare once again, and it reached out unnecessarily to take a case, which probably indicates that it's going to weaken that law even further. I guess what I'm saying to you, that on the one hand, the U.S. left can be excused for not developing a wider base, given the fact that there has been a Rhodesia established amongst the Euro-American majority since 1776. But on the other hand, it would seem to me that that left would take lessons from black history. The lesson from black history is that the reason we've been able to push back successfully is not only because of unrelenting struggle, but because we've been able to broker alliances with the antagonists of Washington. That goes back to London in 1776. That goes back to Mexico at the turn of the 20th century. That goes back to Moscow. I'm speaking now of Paul Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois, Shirley Graham Du Bois, Claudia Jones of Trinidad and Tobago. That goes back to alliances with the African liberation movements and all the rest. Instead, we still have this rather naive reliance upon domestic factors to transform this right-wing juggernaut.
That's a very strong point. The president next heads to Australia, where the G20 summit is taking place. And here, there is going to be some kind of, one assumes, some kind of interaction with Russia's Vladimir Putin. What do you expect? Which of course, is interesting because the G20 nations had expelled Russia from the summit because of pressure from the United States. How do you think the president's participation in the G20 summit is going to be received, especially in light of the relationship the United States is now having with Russia?
Well, my understanding is that the Prime Minister of Australia, Tony Abbott, has spoken in disparaging terms about Moscow, and has spoken even about confronting President Putin physically, which I don't think would be a wise idea since Putin has a black belt in judo. But my understanding is that this alleged and attempted expulsion did not take place, so I assume that Vladimir Putin will show up in Brisbane. In any case, the United States is in a very disadvantageous position right now because of this shift in the global correlation of forces. Not only this close relationship between Beijing and Moscow, but also, as you probably know, Russia is necessary for an accord with Iran. That is to say, the United States is now pressuring Iran to move away from its nuclear facilities that it's developed, that Iran says, or non-military and or civilian in purpose, but under pressure from the Israeli lobby in Washington, that proposed accord between Iran on the one hand and Russia, United States, and the UN Security Council plus Germany on the other is now up in the air. And that has a lot to do not only with the fact that the Israeli lobby is against this, but also because Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel has more support in Congress and in Washington than he does in the Israeli Knesset. Not only that, but you've probably seen these reports in recent days and hours about supposed alleged Russian incursions into Ukraine, which inevitably there will be pressure in the United States to confront Russia on this. I should also add that some of that pressure, interestingly enough, will be coming from the U.S. left, which, as you know, has had a historic anti-Moscow sector within it. But the problem is that Russia is part of the rising bloc led by China, which not only includes that bilateral alliance, but also includes the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which in many ways is more formidable than its competitor, that is to say the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, led by the United States. The BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, are in no mood to tag along behind the United States in terms of confronting Moscow. And so it's going to be very difficult for President Obama to effectively confront Moscow, even though there's going to be enormous pressure to do so, pressure not least emanating from the right, the center, and the left in the United States of America.
Which brings the question, therefore, that when you take a look at this Asian pivot, going back to that, China may have literally bolstered its stature as a global leader in shielding Russia against any aggression from the United States.
Well, that's true. And I think that you need to understand that there are economics underlying this. I mean, some of the natural gas deals that have been brokered between Moscow and Beijing, by some estimates, are the largest business deals ever consummated on planet Earth, involving hundreds of billions of dollars. What's even more striking about these natural gas deals is that pipelines are not now being built from Russia into China. And that could mean that natural gas that ordinarily would flow to Eastern Europe and also Germany and also points west will no longer flow westward. They'll be flowing eastward, raising the possibility and the prospect, A, of Europeans freezing in the dark, and B, Europeans being pressured to break with the United States with regard to its anti-Moscow mania for fear of having their energy supplies cut off. All of this is taking place as we speak, and all of it does not bode well for the foreign policy, not only of Barack Obama, but of the United States of America as a whole.
But also in this accord, the preliminary agreement that has been agreed to between China and Russia, there is big money in this business of trying to reduce carbon emissions into the atmosphere. There's a great deal of money here. So apart from the fact that, yes, it is about climate change, it's also about a huge new industry that could generate a lot of money.
You are correct. Germany is on the fast track towards clean energy. So is Denmark, and so is China, for that matter. At the same time, you recall the case of Solyndra, this U.S. clean energy phenomenon that collapsed in a heap and mountain of debts in recent months and years. One of the reasons, one of the many reasons that China was able to negotiate this climate change accord with the United States is not only because they were trying to provide a deliverable to President Obama to flash once he returned to Washington, but also China sees clean energy as the future, and as they see it, they have the pole position, that Chinese entities are in a privileged position to benefit from the advent of clean energy, and so therefore it's to China's benefit to try to push the world in that direction. I should also say that there are some possible clouds on the Chinese horizon. What I mean is that despite the fact that China and India are yoked together in the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, the fact is that it's no secret that relations between New Delhi and Beijing are not ideal. You know that China and India fought a brief war in 1962, that even since then, including within the last year, there have been sharp clashes between the two on this ill-defined border that separates China and India. We also know that one of the longest-standing relationships in human history is that between India and Japan, which stretches back 2,500 years to the founding of Buddhism, a religion that, as you know, has sunk deep roots in both India and Japan. We also know that relations between Japan and China are far from ideal. I'm sure you saw that stony-faced handshake between Prime Minister Shinzo Abe of Tokyo and President Xi Jinping of China. I mean, I understand that before the handshake that Prime Minister Abe tried to make small talk with President Xi, and President Xi wouldn't even respond. He looked right past him as if he were not there. We know that in recent years there have been physical attacks on Japanese entities in China. It's a very poor relationship that's exacerbated by territorial disputes over small and uninhabited islands that separate the two. And India and Japan are seen by Washington as being part of this pivot. But the problem there is that a high-level Chinese delegation was just in New Delhi. New Delhi is banking on a Chinese investment to improve its deteriorating infrastructure, and that'll probably take altitude and take flight in coming months and years. And it's suggested by Shinzo Abe trying to improve relations with Beijing, one of Japan's major trading partners, if not leading trading partners, China. And if Japan is to pull itself out of its present economic tailspin, it'll have to depend upon Chinese growth. All of this does not bode well for the pivot towards Asia inaugurated by President Obama at the onset of his administration.
Well, it's also wider. We have China now and the East, essentially, becoming more and more important to leaders of the South, Brazil and economies of the South and the Caribbean and so forth. Therefore, all the more interest in containing China's influence. But how do you read this this gravitation of the South to the East?
It's very significant. It's one of the reasons why the pivot engineered by Washington towards China, confronting China, is going to have difficulty gaining traction. You know that just before the so-called Sunnyland Summit in Southern California between President Obama and President Xi Jinping in June 2013, the Chinese leadership sat down with the Caribbean leaders in Trinidad and Tobago, and that led to enormous deals emanating from that summit. You also know, I'm sure, that Chinese interests have invested heavily in the Bahamas, and that is right off the southern tip of Florida. We also know that one of the many reasons why Havana has been able to stay afloat despite unremitting enmity from Washington is because of its close relations with China. I should also mention in that context the close relations with Moscow. And in fact, in recent months, both President Putin and President Xi Jinping have visited Havana. We know that Chinese interests are now negotiating with Nicaragua to build a canal across Nicaragua from the Pacific coast to the Atlantic coast, which will then challenge the U.S.-dominated Panama Canal. We know that one of the reasons why Venezuela has been able to keep its head above water is because it's sending an ever larger supply of its petroleum to China. We know that one of Brazil's leading trading partner, if not its leading trading partner, is China. That Argentina, which is now involved in a death match with U.S.-based investors who are claiming that Buenos Aires reneged on paying back bondholders. In response, Argentina has tried to get ever closer to China in order to better confront these bondholders on Wall Street. We've had many, many discussions about China and Africa, and given what I've just said, I hope alert listeners are now scratching their heads about why there's so much focus on Chinese attention to Africa, when actually you have Chinese attention to every continent on this small planet. It's if there are those who unintentionally or intentionally are saying that Africa does not have the right to get on this gravy train, but Europe does, South America does, Latin America does, the Caribbean does, every place but China. I mean, it's quite questionable, I must say. But given all of what I've just said, once again, to reiterate, it's going to be very difficult for the United States to gain traction for any sort of pivot towards China. And in any case, it's going to be very difficult for the United States itself to move in that direction because, as noted, U.S. corporations, too, have a pretty penny invested in China, which they would not want to see jeopardized. But that's going to create conflict within the U.S. ruling elite because, as you probably noticed, the New York Times is not part of this gravy train. Apparently, there's not much of a market for an English language publication in China. And as a result, New York Times coverage of China has been quite sharp, quite critical. And you may have noticed that in the press conference yesterday between President Xi with President Xi and President Obama, one of the questions on the table was the conflict between the New York Times and China, and the sharp coverage of China by the New York Times, up to and including major exposés seeking to show that the Chinese leadership itself, including the family of President Xi Jinping, are benefiting handsomely. In fact, outgoing Prime Minister Wen Jiabao, the New York Times accused his family of being billionaires as a result of sweetheart deals engineered by Beijing. Those sorts of stories have not gone down well. It's not gone down very well in China. But the bottom line is that they also represent a rift in the highest reaches of the U.S. ruling elite, which is going to make it very difficult for that elite to move in unison against China, even if they have on board the abnormally feckless U.S. left.
Well, after Australia, the president, of course, comes home. Who is this president now after the election?
Well, that's a good question. Obviously, the Republicans are feeling their oats. I mean, even though only one-third of the electorate turned out and an untold number of voters were kept away as a result of voter ID laws and other forms of voter suppression, that kind of legislation will obviously be on the fast track in the upcoming Congress. Apparently, there is going to be an executive action by the president on immigration, but as noted, the Republicans are threatening, or at least some Republicans are threatening, to shut down the government if that takes place. During this lame duck session before the new Congress comes into town in January 2015, apparently there will be some efforts to get some nominations approved, nominations for ambassadorial positions, probably not nominations for federal judgeships. And by the way, I should mention in this context that there has been a substantial number of Democratic-appointed federal judges confirmed during the last months of this Obama, the last months of this outgoing Congress, which may be good news. We'll have to wait and see. It's difficult to say what kinds of initiatives the Obama administration is going to put forward in January 2015, given the unremitting hostility from the Republicans. I mean, you notice that President Obama came out in favor of net neutrality. That is to say, that is a positive development, I would say, because it would suggest that persons like yourself and myself don't have to worry about a slower internet connections as opposed to, say, those favored by these internet giants like Verizon and AT&T, for example. You had Republican opponents of net neutrality coming out against net neutrality only because Obama came out in favor of it. Matter of fact, if you ask them to explain net neutrality, they probably couldn't explain it. They're just against it because Obama's in favor of it.
So but that's here, too, Gerald, you have this hypocrisy, really. Here's a president, conveniently, after being trounced, picking up an issue that he'd been asked to trumpet early on. But, of course, his appointee to the FCC, who was a major campaign donor and who comes out of the media world, the consolidated, seriously corporate media world, under his tenure, they did everything possible to make it so that the giants of the industry could prevail no matter what the changes might be in terms of FCC regulations. And now, having left, is one of the leading lobbyists. So you have, I mean, he can't have it both ways, this president.
Well, I think that you're making the point I was trying to make earlier, that the president of the United States is basically the chairman of the board. And I don't know if you've ever chaired a meeting, but if you have, you know that as chairperson of the meeting, you may be first amongst equals. But you also know that if you did not express the will of the body, you're basically going to be ousted. And what that means in the United States of America is that because the working class movement is so weak, because the forces of black liberation are relatively weak, this at the same time strengthens the highest reaches of the U.S. ruling elite. And that is the body and that is the force that Mr. Obama has to speak to. And what that means is that if they want a chairman of the FCC who's going to protect the interests of big capital, generally speaking, their will be executed, not least because the forces of opposition are relatively weak. And one of the reasons the forces of opposition are relatively weak, as noted, is because they don't have an accurate or correct estimate of the forces, the correlation of forces on the ground. They refuse to take into account the strain of right-wing populism that courses throughout the white working class and white middle class. This is the point that I've been trying to make. And so, therefore, it seems to me that we will perpetually be in trouble, perpetually on the verge of all being subjected to mass internment until and unless we come up with a correct estimate of the forces on the ground and then try to broker the global alliances that will rescue us from this dire plight.
Well, the results of the election should have compelled a dramatic reevaluation with respect to the relationship between the president and his party to the people, because, of course, they rejected them, whether by default or whether by intention. But here's an interesting question. I really wanted to know what your view is. The president seems to be picking up speed. A lot of things are, you know, he's in denial, it seems, because he's not expressed publicly that essentially they screwed up big time, and that there is a commitment or a recommitment to getting things done in terms of listening to what people articulate as the priorities of the country. So he's doing a lot of things. This pivot, of course, being one of them. But in picking up all the speed, as I asked the question, is this the kind of speed one picks up when going downhill?
I see you're being witty now, I see.
I got to try.
Well, it's a number of ways to look at it. One way to look at it is that President Obama is not running for re-election, that he has to take into account less the entreaties of people like outgoing Senator Mark Udall and others who pressured him not to do anything about immigration for fear that it would empower their Republican opponents, who were empowered anyway. And so one could make the argument that President Obama is freer now than he's ever been, and that if you're going to see a real Obama, then this is the time you'll see this real Obama, and hopefully this proclamation on net neutrality and this announcement that he plans to do something about immigration are indications and indicators of the real Obama. Now, of course, realistically speaking, what this means is that there is an ever closer prospect of a shutdown of the government. There's an ever closer prospect of an impeachment circus as well, even though he may be impeached like Bill Clinton, I don't think that he'll be removed, just like Clinton was not removed. But at the same time, let me also issue a cautionary note to Mr. Obama's most stalwart and fervent supporters, who are, of course, heavily embedded in the black community. That is to say, as Mr. Obama has made perfectly and crystal clear, his job is to protect the interests of the United States of America, and given the correlation of forces, that means protecting the interests of the upper reaches of the ruling elite of the United States of America. That can be and probably is in conflict with the needs of the black community, because what we need to do is broker alliances with those who the U.S. ruling class considers to be antagonists, including Havana, including the BRICS nations, including Moscow, including Iran, etc. And until we in the black community reconcile that particular contradiction, we're going to be in more trouble than anybody in this country.
But this brings me back to your earlier criticisms of the left. I had said that if there ever was a time that we should have had a wide spectrum of political alternatives to choose from, this would have been the time. But we haven't seen that emerge. Secondly, the parties that do exist, you look at the very, very poor performance of the Green Party, for example, and one wonders, well, gee, you've been around for quite a while now. You should be able to at least get, at least 1% of the vote. What the heck is going on here?
Well, I think that the U.S. left should draw reasonable inferences from the fact that right now, as of today, the probable replacement of Barack Obama as U.S. president will probably be to his right. I'm speaking of Hillary Rodham Clinton or the array of Republican clowns, Jeb Bush, Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, et al. That should be an indication about what the correlation of forces are in the United States of America, or at least what the correlation of forces are in that body known as white America. Speaking of which, I was in California just a few days ago, and as you know, the Republican Party is a dead letter in the state of California. One of the many reasons that is the case is because because California has a large Latino population, about 33%, a black population of about 11%, and an Asian population, Asian Pacific population, about 11%. In other words, you have a majority of people of color, and you would think that the left would study that and come to the conclusion that if the left is going to make traction or get traction, it has to speak more directly to the concerns of people of color and black people in particular who vote 9-1 against the right. You would think that given the fact that the most stalwart opponents of the white right are black women who vote at a higher rate than, say, black men, that the U.S. left would be thickly populated at the top by black women. That is not the case, as you well know. You would think that the left would draw inferences from what I've just said and put forward issues that are designed to appeal to the most stalwart anti-conservative voters. Issues like affirmative action, issues like opposition to mass incarceration, issues like reparations for decades and centuries of unpaid labor by enslaved Africans. But we don't see that. Instead, we see what amounts to a sort of naive kind of non-racialism where race doesn't matter, where even race doesn't matter even when it comes to black people at the top of the pyramid. I mean, for example, can you think of any analysis that has been done by the U.S. left that draws a parallel between the bad old days of lynching, when those more likely to be lynched were oftentimes the black affluent because their very existence was seen as a direct threat to the premises of white supremacy, which, of course, you can draw a straight line to that today. For example, you're in Los Angeles, for example, you're more likely as a black man to be stopped driving a Mercedes than driving the kind of jalopy that I drive, for example. And of course, there's a reason why I drive a jalopy, precisely because of that reason. But you don't see that sort of analysis applied to what's happening right now in Washington, for example. What's happening right now with regard to the White House, for example. It's as if the discussion of white supremacy is desiccated and abstract and not concrete. And this is one of the many reasons why the U.S. left is so weak as we speak.
Well, Gerald Horn, I want to thank you. Always, always, you bring incredible insight to the issues of the day. And I want to thank you for this class that you just conducted. I hope it has registered on our listeners today. Thank you for being with us once again.
Thank you for inviting me.
This brings us to the end of our program today. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Economic Update with Richard Wolff. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company.